All right, so good morning, everyone. Welcome to the House of the Risen Sun with Bruce Rawls and Lynn Johnson. And Bruce, I have on the phone right now or on Skype. Good morning, Bruce. What's going on with you today?
Good morning, Lynn. Well, just the usual, the forgiveness classroom. So hope all's well with everyone listening.
Oh, yeah.
And yourself, of course.
Absolutely. You know, I had a really interesting thing this week. Well, first off, I saw that you called last week, and I thought you weren't going to be on last week, so I had put on a recording. But
yeah, that worked out great because I actually was trying to keep the household quiet because we had house guests here, and they don't get up as early as this. so that worked out great.
Yeah. Well, good. All right. Well, yeah, and I had a lot of internet problems last week. In fact, I had to have my entire internet went down, including, the wireless, everything. And so it was pretty dramatic for me because, you know, I live on the internet. So
mm-hmm.
so it was going flaky on Saturday, and by Sunday afternoon, it was gone completely. And so I had to wait until Wednesday to get it back at all.
Oh,
so,
okay.
Yeah, so I didn't have any internet for like 3 days, if you can imagine that. And I survived. It was pretty amazing.
Live to tell about it. Amazing.
But guess, now this is, talk about a forgiveness classroom. Wednesday was when the guy was coming, the tech was coming to fix the internet. So I was quite anxious about that and really, you know, thinking, you know, it'll be great to have that back and be able to, you know, do what I do. And so early in the morning, I was out watering my plants, messing with my garden. And, you know, I've talked about the problems with the next door neighbors and all the shenanigans and stuff that goes on over there. Well, I heard, I thought it was the old man, the grandpa. I thought that they had locked him out of the house because I'm hearing, open the door, open the door. And so, you know, I go over there to take a peek and see what's going on, see if I can help him out. And I get up on my deck and I look out to my driveway, and there are FBI agents armed and pointing their guns surrounding the next door neighbor's house, and local Leos and all that stuff. All my NCIS is coming in handy, but this whole like a raid was going on, and they raided the house. The old man was not there; he was somewhere else because he hasn't been staying over there because of all the hijinks and shenanigans going on. So. Anyway, they arrested all the kids that were there. They're, you know, like kids, I say, between, you know, maybe I think one of the girls was 16, one was 19, and they were the ones that had stolen a truck. But they took them all, and then they ransacked or, you know, searched the house, and then the next thing you know, here's the health department and here's people with masks and everything coming in. And, they actually condemned the house. They took out 10 dogs and 2 cats were the only ones they could catch. There's probably a dozen cats that lived in the house. They left a flap open on the door so the cats could come in and out after they left. My next door neighbor, the house is condemned. There's crews working out there, and they're probably going to end up tearing the house down. So,
wow.
Yeah.
a little drama in the local life of Lynn, huh?
In the cul-de-sac. But what was so amazing to me was all the people, and I know all these people. I've lived here for 17 years in this little cul-de-sac. I know all these people, and they're all out in the street, like basically having a street party because they're so excited and so happy that, you know, this thing is going down. And apparently the young lady, the girl, had next door neighbor had burglarized one of these neighbors' houses. I didn't know that, and stole a bunch of electronics and, you know, all kinds of stuff. So, you know, everybody in the cul-de-sac is just rejoicing that this has happened. And I'm looking at it like, what a tragedy. And they're all, like, really happy. And in a way, I'm kind of relieved that all this stuff is over, pretty much. I mean, it's the beginning of a whole nother story. But you know, for the last, I don't know, year or so, it's just been, since the girl was in prison, she got out of prison last year, and ever since then, it's just been, the neighborhood's been terrorized with junkies walking up and down the street. This is suburban America. We live in a university park, which is kind of an upscale, middle-class neighborhood here in Pueblo. And so for something like this to be happening in our neighborhood is just really shocking to everyone. And now we have a condemned house next door, and, you know, probably going to end up having it torn down because it, apparently they had so many animals in there for so long that everything is ruined, basically. So talk about, you know, wow, you know, rush to judgment, thoughts of fear, intimidation, all these things going on in Linland here. And it's like, you know, what is this for? What is this for? And I've just come to realize that nothing is really for anything. And there's no meaning to it. And the only thing that has any meaning is the relationship that we have with our brothers.
Exactly. Boy, that is so well said. I mean, that's it. I think that's what makes the transition from the ego to the Holy Spirit not only doable, but it continues to draw us out of the ego's insanity and into the mind of peace, really, that really embraces everyone as one. And like you say, that I think looking at those judgments and condemnations is crucial. I was listening to one of Ken Wapnick's audios the last day or two, and he was talking about how when Bin Laden was captured, how, you know, people were celebrating and so forth, and you know, while on the one hand, on the level of form, you know, if there's someone who appears to have been perpetrated a crime, you know, bringing those to justice on the world's terms, certainly, you know, there's nothing wrong with you know, getting people who are doing harm to the public out of harm's way, or out of their own way sometimes. But at the same time, like you say, when you find yourself condemning the person rather than the behavior, that's where I think we get into the turf of, you know, the mind, which is, you know, and, you know, in our heart of hearts, when we can say to ourselves, there's no one bar none that is exempt from God's love, and we are all that in truth, masquerading as all these seemingly separate selves. If we can, you know, remember that when those things are, like you say, coming down, that is real, real helpful, isn't it?
It is. And it's not, you know, I know what you were just saying. You don't condemn the person. You don't condemn the behavior either.
Because right.
Actually, the reality of it is that we're basically pretty helpless as far as behaviors in this world. The story of the script is written, and the only thing that I can do is recognize that it's a story and not engage in it as if it was a reality. And you know, I that's maybe easier said than done, but it definitely is easier done if you practice it. And so practicing forgiveness is really the way that you come to the point where you can look on a world of devastation and recognize that it's not true, that it could never have happened, and that what I'm seeing is pixels on a screen, you know? I mean, basically.
That is such a helpful metaphor. I think the pixels, you know, the fact that it's all essentially a digital one and zero illusion, when in reality there's just oneness, there's no nothing. But the nothing is the space that we make between the imaginary zeros and the ones that, you know, that seems to be real, and the stuff that we make up about it, everything from, you know, quarks to quasars, and anything involving time and space is really just something we've chosen to believe in, and that choosing is purposive because we think we've shattered perfect oneness. You know, it seems like, like Ken Wapnick says, you can't really get that far from the metaphysics of the Course if we want to stay in that peace and have that peace, you know, develop into a lasting, sustainable awareness, which is really basically recognizing that the ego's insanity is intrinsically unstable and unsustainable, and it's like a, you know, an upside down pyramid or something like that. You know, it's just like it's going to fall over. You know, so it's you know, destined to fail and designed to fail. So when we can kind of forgive ourselves for having indulged in that kind of thinking, that's, I think, what helps us get through the craziness that we see around us and remember that it's not only a projection of our unconscious stuff, the sin, guilt, fear paradigm of the ego, but also it's unfounded. It's unconscious, but it's unfounded. And that's where, you know, I keep coming back to, you know, Ken Wapnick's brilliant assessment of Freud's dream analysis, where he says, you know, that Freud correctly, described dreams as the royal road to the unconscious. He said, but he just didn't extend it far enough to include the waking dreams that we call everyday, you know, so-called normal reality, which involves everything having to do with space and time and individuality and you know, ego's whole thought system projected out, isn't it?
Yeah, and you know, I'm not even sure that Freud was aware of that particular, you know, who knows that this world is a dream.
Well, I don't
know. Unless you've experienced it as such. You know, I wasn't saying that he did. I was just thinking, you know, how could he have extended that into this world if he didn't understand, even though he did know that projection makes perception. And actually, literally, everybody does know that projection makes perception. They just don't understand what it means, or they don't understand that that's what they're doing. This question that you picked out really looks good. It ties right into what we're saying, what we're talking about here. So I posted the link on the board, I think. Let me see here. Did it not get posted? That's one good thing of having Gather on two different computers, is I can tell if something is working or not. And that did not post. So let me try it again. Oh, you know, I'm like logged in as the admin. Okay. There I say. Oh, there it is. Okay, good. All right. So, let's take a look at it. FACIM, it's for the folks on the radio, it's facimoutreach.org, that's facimoutreach.org/QA/question287.htm#Q1324. So that, if you followed that. Oh, it did post twice. I didn't see it, Carrie. Weird. So this is the link in the question. And do you want to read the question, Bruce?
Sure. This one starts out, again, we're reading frequently asked question number 1324 from the folks from Temecula, as I call them, the Foundation for A Course in Miracles Outreach, frequently asked questions. And this is... it starts out with a question that says, I was playing chess on the computer and began to think that I was wasting my life doing this. I'm not being spiritual enough. The other side of the coin is thinking I'm good because I spent a lot of time with my kids. I'm aware of the ego traps in this, but I think underneath it is the idea that I have to sacrifice things in the world to let go enough to undo the ego, especially in light of passages from the Course that seem to teach that if we don't fulfill our function, we have indeed wasted our life. That's intimidating. What would it mean to fulfill your function? is watching myself getting mad at myself for playing on the computer part of fulfilling my function? Is it possible to fulfill your function a little or for a little while and then slip? I always feel like I'm being graded. So, a good question, because I think we're all on some level or another, whether consciously aware of it or not, it really touches on the unconscious guilt that the Course in Miracles is fundamentally and quintessentially about undoing and replacing it with the, you know, undoing it through the forgiveness and replacing that guilt with the innocence and the peace and the true loving kindness that really exists between all creation that we're just not consciously aware of most of the time.
Exactly. And this question, wow, I mean, it's loaded as you were reading. I was looking at, oh my gosh, look at all these different thoughts and ideas and beliefs. And basically that's what it is. It's beliefs about, you know, who I am, what I am, what I'm here for, what my function is. And then this last statement, I always feel like I'm being graded. Well, bingo, because guess who's grading you? Just like I'm always grading everyone else, I'm grading myself. So
yep.
And so let's see what. And you know what? That's what the answer says. Let me start with the first paragraph of the answer. The last statement is quite important. I always feel like I'm being graded. Spoken as a good, healthy ego. I could just hear Ken say that, can't you? Uh-huh. That is what you want to look at, because it indicates your study of A Course in Miracles must be being guided by the ego. Guilt distorts. And let's just, right there, two things. It's, you're being guided by the ego, and guilt distorts. Right away when I hear I'm being guided by the ego, what happens? Is I feel guilty.
Cringe, right. Yeah, yeah. Well, that's it. I mean, because the only aspect of our consciousness that can feel guilty is ego. I mean, because there is no guilt in the perfect oneness that the Course suggests is really the correct province of the mind and all that is in the real mind, if you will, or the right mind. And so if we're feeling anything less than peace, that's complete and unequivocal and unending, then we obviously still have some forgiveness work to do, as the Course would describe it. We still have some ego undoing to do. And, exactly. And there's nothing wrong with that. Otherwise, why would there even be this curriculum if we didn't all have that, you know, on our plate, so to speak?
Exactly. And to a greater extent than what we believe. And I know a lot of students of Course in Miracles who really believe that they're like right on the edge of full enlightenment. And I know.
Well, there may be. How do we know? We don't know what's going on in anyone else's mind, do we?
Right. You don't know. But what I do know is that I've been working damn hard on this for a long, long, long time. And when I look at my thinking and I look at my mind, I see still much guilt, blame, shame, fear. I see I have so much to work on. And so, you know, I thought I was that way too. I thought, I'm real close to becoming fully awakened here. That's why I can talk about it, I guess, is because, you know, you get the idea that, you know, you do the lessons. I know people who have done the lessons of the Course and thought, you know, that's it. I just need to do the lessons and I'll become enlightened. And when they don't, they become really disillusioned. And that says a couple things to me. I'm not going to go into it in depth. But one thing is that they really didn't do the lessons. Even if you think you did the lessons, if you didn't do what Jesus told you to do, which is like give up all judgment, forget the world, you know.
And then I always like to remind people when they say forget this world, forget this course, there's an order there. There's a sequence I try not to give undue importance and make it special, but I think there might be a helpful clue there that you forget the world first and then forget the course. Anyway.
Right. So if you did the lessons of A Course in Miracles and you have not forgotten the world, then you probably didn't really do the lessons. You just maybe read the lessons and said the lessons every, 15 minutes or, 10 minutes every hour or something. You probably did these things, but you didn't really do what was being asked of you, which was to forget about the world and give up judgment.
Yeah, exactly. And I think this is, touches on another familiar theme, which is that we have enormous resistance to really actually applying this material in our minds, because when we do, ultimately, and I think that's why that fifth stage in the five stages of, or the six stages of trust that are in the Manual for Teachers, the fifth stage is essentially, the dark night of the soul, which is the basically where you look at all the identity investment that we have and how subtle and how sneaky we've programmed our egos to be, because it's what's really a testament to the brilliance of our mind, which is actually, it should be an encouragement that, once we switch the thought system over, that our mind given to Holy Spirit really is omnipotent, but we've used that same energy. And as my friend and colleague Leonard Lasko used to say, it takes an enormous amount of energy to maintain the belief in separation. We collectively have harnessed the power of what appears to be an incredibly immense system of energy and matter and space and time to build an entire cosmology that we call the material universe, solely for the purpose. And this is where, it's kind of an outrageous statement for somebody who's new to the course, but we made this only for the sole purpose of hiding out from unconscious guilt and for believing that we split up this, it's kind of like when the Beatles split up, we think that we should feel bad, we broke up the cosmic band in this case, we broke up the holy family of perfect oneness. Well, no, we just are having a dream, like Freud says, but it's our dreams that get us back to that awareness. It's looking at the contents of our mind through our projections, reeling them in, realizing that nothing that seems to be outside of myself, whether it's young people being arrested and hauled away next door, or cats vomiting on the carpet and having to get out the new carpet cleaner, or a thermonuclear war, or hangnail, hangnails to Holocaust. It's all that, the whole spectrum is all the same stuff. Anything that disturbs our peace of mind, and if we give it that power, we're saying, I'm choosing to invest in the belief that my projections, which I made unconsciously to keep me separate and keep me feeling imprisoned and in essentially in misery, that's more important than the peace that is within, that has always been waiting patiently and gently for my return. Now, absolutely. having said that, I think it's important to not beat up on ourselves when we do start recognizing and start uncovering in a more serious way by actually practicing and doing the exercises and the course, and particularly the workbook lessons. Putting into practice, not just a theory and from head to heart kind of thing. That's when, the rubber meets the road, and it does get challenging. And we need to be very patient with ourselves and very gentle with ourselves as those things are uncovered, and just say, wow, how profound is the power of my mind, and not little m, my, but the capital M, that we collectively made up an entire universe just to hide out from a revenge from a schizophrenic God that we also made up, little g God, yeah. Lowercase g, because we think we blew up perfect oneness. We think we shattered it in a seemingly infinite number of pieces, but it didn't happen.
It's just an excuse.
Right, right.
It really is just an excuse, because we know that it did not really happen.
Yes.
But we have to keep up the impression, we have to keep up the illusion of it being, because we are actually here, it's purposive. And when it is purposive, because we're still, it's still a part of the, dare I say, attack on God.
Mm-hmm.
It's still a part of our temper tantrum.
Right.
At not being made special.
And we are all tantrum yoga masters here.
We are all tantrum yoga masters, exactly. And so we built this, this world, this universe, which we continue, we extend on and on and on. I mean, there's no universe extending beyond our mind. Mm-hmm. But in our mind, it's extended on and on and on, and it's being held together by a dynamic tension that is so energy intensive that it's all we can do really to even remain halfway or even a partially conscious. We're putting so much energy into making this appearance of a world that we're barely able to do anything else. And so any forays into consciousness that we do, that are brought to us by the practicing of the lesson, by the looking and judging not, the just realizing I need do nothing and then not doing anything. You know, these are the things that, bring us, it is the practicing of the lessons that bring us to that little peep through a little tiny crack at what reality is.
Uh-huh. A little glimmer coming through.
The little glimmer coming through. But as we focus on that, and, you know, it's the crack that lets the light in. So, I mean, those metaphors really have a meaning if you're thinking about our actual situation or what we think is happening here. And so, you know, that's what all this work is for. All this work is for opening up that little crack. It's not for, you know, blah, heaven is here. No, that's not, that's not how it works. It's like that little crack, and that little crack in itself becomes heaven, because you can go back to it over and over and over again when the world seems to be falling apart or things don't seem right or, you know, politics are going crazy. You know, whatever. I've really had a tremendous shift since the election as far as the rush to judgment and the fear. Just looking at the fear that I was projecting because I was imagining that what was happening was real. And thinking, if I, who have been working on this for so long, I mean, I was a Buddhist when I was, you know, 20. I've done this for years and years and years and years. I'm even before that, you know, so all that work, all these years, and I'm 64 years old, and I'm finally starting to see the crack. You know, that says something about, you know, what this work is and how, either that or I'm just really a crappy student. And that could be too.
I think we are all really unnecessarily mean and hard on ourselves. You know, we really, and then I was just flipping to paragraph 8 in lesson 95, which to me, I think is, and Ken Wapnick points this out in one of his talks. He says, you know, that's where Jesus departs from the suggested, you know, discipline of starting out with, you know, hey, once or twice a day, and finally it's, you know, like every 5 or 10 minutes or 15 minutes, whatever it is. And he says, the Holy Spirit is not delayed in his teaching by your mistakes. He can be held back only by your unwillingness to let them go. Let us therefore be determined, particularly for the next week or so, well, ongoing, however long it takes really, to be willing to forgive ourselves for our lapses in diligence and our failures to follow the instructions for practicing the day's idea. This tolerance for weakness will enable us to overlook it rather than give it power to delay our learning. If we give it power to do this, we are regarding it as strength and are confusing strength with weakness. And I think that's, and it goes on, and it's, you know, it's merely a mistake, it calls for correction and nothing else. So it says, to allow a mistake to continue is to make additional mistakes. So basically, you know, when we notice the resistance, that's when we realize, okay, just push a little more. You know, don't knock yourself out necessarily, or get put yourself in a situation where it backfires and you know you're in an ego tailspin. But just look at what's going on in your mind, and if you've given it an honest effort and you find the resistance is too great, you know, like it says elsewhere, you know, don't fight yourself. Because ultimately, you know, we're already home, just dreaming of exile, as the Course says. So we can afford to be patient with ourselves. And it's really that patience that really helps us undo the resistance. And the willingness to not condemn ourselves when we notice the resistance. I think that's really helpful, isn't it?
It is. And that to forgive myself and to recognize that, it's not me. That it really has nothing to do with me and my effort. It has to do with my willingness. And effort and willingness are two entirely different things to me. Mm-hmm. Because because when I'm efforting, I think I know what I'm doing. And I think I'm doing something that I'm supposed to be doing, and I'm imagining an outcome. But if I'm willing, the first thing that I, in my opinion anyway, my thought is I have to drop all ideas of what the outcome should be. I have to drop all my ideas of what I think should be happening. I give up my I give up my opinion, and just then whatever happens, I bless. I look at it and say, well, this is it. You know, the cops are outside. You know, I came in the house. I told my daughter, keep your head down. You know, that's all I thought. You know, keep your head down. If shots get fired, you know, I don't want you peeking out the window and getting in the crossfire. You know, I'm thinking fearful thoughts. But really, that's it. You know, when you think everything's going to hell, keep your head down. You know, don't stick your nose into it. Don't run away from it. Don't try to defend it. Just let it be. Just let it be. And, you know, obviously a happy outcome is guaranteed. Obviously the end is always going to be, happily ever after. So what do I have? I don't know the script. I don't know what's going to happen next. All I know is where I am right now. And so that willingness is to just let go of my desire to go somewhere, be something, have things come out a certain way. You know, just give that up and let the Holy Spirit be in charge. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to go back. I think we've strayed here.
I think we've covered some good ground, actually, because it really is important to forgive ourselves. And I was actually, as you were talking, it triggered something that reminded me of today's workbook review lesson, which is, it can be but my gratitude I earn. And I was thinking, well, that's interesting, because usually you think of earning other things, but earning gratitude, you know, is really, if you think about it, we don't really have to earn it because it's already there. So in a sense, you know, there's really nothing to earn or learn in the Course. It's really unlearning. Since, and again, you know, I keep coming back to Ken Wapnick's brilliance, where he, among many of his favorite expressions, he says it's a course in not know. Meaning that it's not a course in affirming what we are, because that takes care of it by itself. You know, and just like the third step in the forgiveness process is written, having the, after we reveal and release, we allow the Holy Spirit to do the replacing, because the replacing is automatic, because that's why Holy Spirit's job seems to be incredibly difficult, but it's actually infinitely easy, because it's just allowing what is to be. And that's really essentially what we're doing when we let go of our resistance, is we allow what we really are to be, and then the gratitude is part of that. That feeling of deep appreciation that is unchanging, that you know, enters our mind when we recognize that this really does work if we are willing to question every value that we hold, and do it consistently. Eventually, we do feel a peace that really is unshakable. And then, you know, when we find ourselves still shaken now and then, we just have to remember, okay, so I allowed that insane thought system, the switch to be flipped over to that position again. And I know that that's the maladaptive solution to the non-existent problem again, as Ken likes to say. But that's okay. You know, I'm going to learn through the law of contrast here that the one thought system of exclusion and separate interests and duality and, you know, the sin, guilt, fear, insanity doesn't work for me. The we, they paradigm. But its opposite, which in truth has really no opposite, but we don't get that until we get pretty close, I think. has no insanity in associated with it. So, but we don't know that, I think, really until we, you know, let go of even in moments of forgiveness of our self-condemnation.
Absolutely. And that whole idea that I must have decided wrongly.
Yeah.
Why? Because I'm not at peace. That could be any time that you're not at peace, you exactly. have decided wrongly. You've already yep. decided. And that's, you know, my favorite section, chapter 5, section 7, the decision for God. Because it really, Jesus talks so clearly to us as if, you know, do you really believe that you can make a voice that can drown out God's? Do you really believe you can devise a thought system that can separate you from Him? Do you really believe you can plan for your safety and joy better than He can?
Well, of course, that's a really big question, because it's not just certain specifics that it applies to. It really applies to everything in our experience that we have just, you know, cherry-picked and selected just certain areas where we want to apply this. And I think that's why it's a long process, because it takes a while to generalize and to see, wow, I applied this in one area of my life, but I can actually apply it to this problematic person or group of people or country for that matter. I mean, it could be or planet. I mean, if we can just kind of step back and look at all the places where we, you know, restrict the application and resist applying it with a sense of gentleness and patience, and realize, well, you know, at some point maybe I will, you know, apply this to an area where I've consistently been disturbed and allow myself the freedom to choose a thought system that really does work for me. So.
Exactly. And so, you know, that's all you have to do. You know, Jesus also, he says, you need neither be careful nor careless.
Mm-hmm.
You don't, it doesn't matter if you're careful. It doesn't matter if you're careless. It doesn't
that's
matter
a good one.
Anything. You yeah. just need to cast your cares upon Him, because He careth for you. You are His care because He loves you. That's it.
It is, yeah. Just real quickly, I think that's another one where it's real easy to get into level of confusion. It doesn't mean not, you know, it doesn't mean, oh, I don't have to wash the dishes or feed the cats or, you know, check the oil in the car. You know, it's none of that kind of stuff. It's basically just saying, I don't need to be worried about the outcome of anything I do in the world.
Exactly.
Because my identity is safe at home in perfect oneness, as is everyone's. And that is really, I think, you know, kind of a real quick guess at how to express that in wordless, you know, awareness. But, you know, but it's really, it's kind of like that. You know what I mean? Because it's not about changing our behavior, doing things differently in the dream of the world that we think we're in. It's about recognizing that nothing that happens or doesn't happen in the world can affect our peace unless we have chosen and decided to give it that power.
Exactly. Well, and you know, I was thinking, you know, you don't have to feed the cat. You don't have to wash the dishes. You don't have to do any of those things. Later on, you're going to think, well, I wish I would have washed the dishes, or, you know, my cat is dead or whatever. But you don't have to do anything. It's your own, you know, desire or whatever, but you know, I think also that Jesus is telling us that at some level, at a certain level, There will come a time, he does tell us this over and over, there at a certain level, there will come a time when you are not living your life, when you are not the motivator of what happens, and you because really you're not living your life, and you're not the motivator of what happens. But we don't realize that because of this level of existence that we believe that we're living. But there is, but the reality, if you knew the reality of your truth, what is really happening, you'd recognize, nope, I'm not driving the car. The car is just driving and the body is in it. But it's not me that's doing it. That's what starts to happen, is you recognize that what is happening is not really what you are. It's not what I am that's doing these things. And it's not what I am that's not doing these things. What I am has nothing to do with this world. And, you know, eventually you come to that point where you recognize that that is the truth. And the only way that I can know, that I know, because Jesus, who I believe wrote this book, told me the way he did it, was by looking at his brother and seeing the Christ. So, yep. You know, that's really a practicing forgiveness. You know, that's really what happens. So, you know, it is possible, and it is, talk about the function or the goal. The function, the goal is to remember who I am, nothing else. So anything in the world, you know, it's just a part of the scenery. And we're going to talk about that. Here, setting the goal, coming up here on this next paragraph. So let me finish reading this paragraph.
Okay. Since we've meandered a bit, should we kind of start with the beginning of the first paragraph?
I think that's a good idea.
Yeah. I think it starts out in a way that kind of recaps the question, too. So.
Okay. Okay. So the last statement, was, I always feel like I'm being graded. It's quite important. Spoken as a good, healthy ego. That is what you want to look at, because that indicates your study of A Course in Miracles must be being guided by the ego. Guilt distorts. That is why there is so much emphasis in the Course on bringing the darkness to the light. Therein lies your function, bringing your guilt to the presence of love in your right mind, or looking at your guilt with the healing eyes of love. And you can do this. Whether you're playing chess on the computer or spending time with your kids, it's not the form, it's the content. You can play chess with guilt or without guilt. You can play with your kids with guilt or without guilt. It is always a question of which teacher you choose beforehand in your mind. And I'm going to say, you don't have to actually choose that teacher beforehand. You can recognize, wait a minute, I'm not thinking, I'm not at peace, and choose again. You can always choose again. And in fact, that's, you know, the big emphasis is that whenever you fall down, you just get up. You know, you just choose again, and it's always there, and nothing is lost.
Exactly. And to give examples to your point there, which is a great one, in this example where this is talking about playing chess or watching TV, you know, if you catch yourself mid thought, or, you know, mid game or mid TV show, doesn't mean, oh, I've got to ride this out with the guilt. No, you can in any given moment, 24/7, 365, down to the picosecond, you know, just down to the tiniest little interval of what we think of as time, we have free will to choose one of those two thought systems. And there are no idle thoughts, because we're either choosing the insanity of ego or the sanity of Holy Spirit any moment, every moment. And it's just like a little toggle switch that goes back and forth between those two all the time. And sometimes it seems like we have it stuck on ego for, you know, months, days, weeks, years, whatever. but it actually, we have little glimmers now and then. We have little moments where, you know, I think the Course calls them light episodes, or, you know, a holy instance where we catch ourselves, and I think the idea is to have more of those and start stitching them together and learning to generalize and realize, you know, I could see peace instead of this. And there's no restriction that says, well, you have to finish this game or this TV show or this relationship or this job or this whatever. I mean, at any given moment, we can shift teachers, and it's not dependent on the circumstances. It never depends on what's happening in space-time. It's always happening, depending on what's happening in the mind, and that's where the true freedom lies.
Exactly, absolutely, and the more you practice it, the more it becomes a natural thing.
Exactly, and
that's what's happened for me is that when I start feeling even the less twinge of uncomfortableness, I can remember right away. And I don't let it go on very long. I do, you know, sometimes I do let it go on, and I have to admit, the reason I let it go on is because there's an entertainment value there of being in upset. There's entertainment value of judging and accusing. And there, I mean, seriously, there's no other reason for it. It's not because there's anything to be accomplished by judging my brother. There's nothing to be won by judging my brother other than to validate my ego thinking. But in general, it's as long as it entertains me and it's not too painful, I'll keep doing it. And fortunately, I've gotten to the point where it is painful and it doesn't entertain me. And when I recognize it, I can stop it. But yeah, still sometimes I fall into it.
Oh, sure. And that's where it's vitally important to, you know, give yourself slack if you feel like you need to take a break, and because there's no time schedule in terms of, you know, you must have your undoing of the ego done by a certain date, or you know you're going to fall into an abyss or anything. There's none of that. It's just, but I think the idea is to remember that you know what this curriculum is suggesting is we are we do have access, and we are choosers of the two thought systems in moment to moment, and that freedom is really what it's suggesting that we exercise and identify with the cause rather than the effect. And I think that's where the word beforehand in that last paragraph is helpful, because beforehand kind of means you kind of go into each situation with expectations. And that mental attitude becomes the cause that we apply to what we're going. You know, if you walk into a meeting or a conversation with a spouse or family member or a coworker or whatever, you know, see somebody, you know, who taking up enough room in the shopping cart aisle that you have to choose another aisle, you know, if you can think of all the things that from the most trivial to the seemingly most big dealness, that's a horrible grammar, but anyway, and look at that without condemnation, including the grammar, and realize that really doesn't have to be something that bothers me. I can look at the bother in my mind and see, wow, what a perfect classroom to look at the unconscious guilt being projected out in this seemingly, you know, outward situation. Or it can be an inward situation. It can be just, you know, wrestling with a self-concept of adequacy and responsibility and do I need to have, you know, something to bolster my worth by doing certain things or feeling like I'm disciplined enough and contributing enough, or, you know, it could be a whole gamut of stuff. Certainly that puritanical work ethic and Western motivation of thinking we have to, you know, solve the world's problems, you know.
the idea of sacrifice.
Yeah. Well, yeah, exactly. And that's the whole sacrifice really is another way of making the dream real, isn't it? It's another way of saying, wow, this world, I have to fix this world. And we all have our dream repair technicians on, hats on, don't we?
Yeah, we sure do. Yeah.
And when you're talking about, you know, horror films and something reminded me of that. And I was like, well, on the level of form, not everybody's a fan of the horror film genre, but on the level of mind, in a sense, we all are here because of our recovering, you know, wanting to recover on some level or another from our addiction to the virtual horror film that we call space-time, you know, and again, like Ken Wapnick says, you know, what do you do when you discover you're in the desert? You leave.
Yeah, you know? Get out there. Yeah. And stop participating. And that's really, I mean, that really is what it is you just stop participating in that particular drama.
Right.
And, you know, recognize that it's not helping anyone. You don't even have to think about it. You know, it's not helpful. It's not helpful to be in judgment in any way. And if recognize that it is judgment, you know, when I'm looking at a situation and saying, this is not good, I don't like this, I wish something else was happening, those are all judgment. And all judgment does is say, I wish it was something other than what it is. Mm-hmm. And as Jesus, or in the lesson 268, so clearly says, let all things be exactly as they are, and let me not be your critic today, Lord. You know?
Yeah, and it's really an arrogance, isn't it? I've been attending the Course in Coffee meetings that Lynn Corona and Tim Wise do on Thursday mornings recently, and very good material they're covering. And one of the ones that they were covering a couple days ago was the arrogance of the ego. And it really is. It's arrogant of us to assume we're not only usurping God's function by thinking that, you know, we're in charge here. You know, we've kind of grabbed the wheel and we're taking over. But we're doing it in a virtual reality game, you know. the reality of where we always have been and always are and always will be hasn't changed a bit. But the, you know, on the dream screen, it seems like, you know, we've gone off and made this authority problem game out of, you know, taking over from perfect oneness and say, I'm in charge here, you know, John Wayne, I can do this. And once we kind of look at that and say, well, yeah, where's that getting me? How's that working out for you? And really with gentle honesty, just say, you know, maybe not so well. then we can, you know, give the wheel back to Holy Spirit. And it doesn't mean we don't do things in the world. Doesn't mean we necessarily change our behavior, but we change what we think about, what seems to be happening. And that helps us release our identification with the dream world and also, choose to identify with like you started out the conversation this morning with, which I think is so important, the relationship that we have with everyone and everything. It's really where the reality is. It's where the beauty is. It's where the kindness is. It's where the things that we truly cherish that are with us eternally. And I think that's why that, you know, early in the text that, you know, I've, you know, saved every loving kindness, I'm paraphrasing greatly, you know, and kept mm-hmm. them and purified them of their errors, you know, because all the things that really do make a difference in the kindnesses that we express and the meaning behind that is really that what we're building and what we're reestablishing and what we're really uncovering, isn't it? So,
yeah. Absolutely.
Should I read the next paragraph?
Absolutely, it is. Yeah, go ahead and read the next paragraph because we could go on and on and on about this.
And we do.
We do. So go ahead with the next paragraph.
Okay. This is the message of two important sections in the text. Setting the goal, and that's chapter 17, section 6, and the consistency of means and end, and that's chapter 20, section 7. Oh, yeah, okay. We first decide on the goal or end we want to attain, and there's the beforehand of the cause, right? For example, peace, seeing our interest as shared with everyone else. And there's that relationship mm-hmm. aspect that's emphasized so much in the Course and why that really, you know, becomes a primary part of our curriculum and our healing classroom of the mind to look at our relationship to everyone and everything. That is why there is so much emphasis in the Course on bringing the darkness to the light. Therein lies your function, bringing your guilt to the presence of love in your right mind or looking at your guilt with the healing eyes of love. And you can do this whether you are playing chess on the computer or spending time with your kids. It's not the form, it's the... Oh, I'm jumping back. I was like, wait.
I was like, but you know what? You can.
Okay, let's pick up right off the top. Okay. Let's see. We first decide on the goal or end we want to attain. For example, peace, seeing our interests as shared with everyone else. Then the activity will be seen as the means to achieve this end. The activity itself, the form, won't matter. The content alone will provide the meaning for you. So it is not what you do that is important, but the purpose you have given to it, with whom you do it, the ego or Jesus. There is no hierarchy of illusions. Some activities are not, quote, good for us and others, quote, bad. Some are not holy and others unholy. Yeah, and the Course says, if there is no world, this is the central thought the Course attempts to teach. So how could an activity or a behavior in a world that exists only in an incredibly elaborate, hallucinogenic, holographic dream be a problem, right?
Exactly.
If it's on the dream screen, it can seem mighty real, but it doesn't make it real.
Exactly. Okay. And that's why the analogy of the movie, you know, if we had gotten this like before movies were invented or television was invented, mm-hmm. we might have a difficult time explaining these things in as clear a way. But when you can look at the movie, you know, and recognize that, you know, as bad as Keanu Reeves, I think, is playing in a movie where he's playing a hitman or some kind of really evil guy. And, you know, I remember him from The Matrix, and I love him. So, you know, can I look and say, oh, God, you know, he's gone dark now, and he's, you know, he's an evil killer? No, no more than he was the Neo in The Matrix. It was a movie. And that's what you have to understand, is that the actor is not responsible for the script. The actor is not responsible for the outcome of the script. The actor is only responsible for doing his lines and being where he's supposed to be, when he's supposed to be there. Mm-hmm. And we are all level of form is all acting. It's not true. It's not real. So we're separated from that because it's not what we are.
Exactly.
So you can't blame a person or blame yourself for, you know, anything that happens in the script. You know, I could feel terribly guilty, and I have felt terribly guilty for not going over to my neighbor's house and doing more outreach with them and trying to help them out. And, you know, in a way, I felt responsible for what was happening over there because I didn't feel like I had done enough. And I realized, well, I did what I could when I could. Why would I blame myself for mm-hmm. things that I have no control over?
Yeah.
I mean, that's exactly what happens. I mean, anyway, go on.
Yeah. I mean, we don't need to be responsible for everyone else's decision in their mind, but we certainly are responsible for what we think about everyone else. And that's it seems like a daunting task and a huge responsibility, but it really is just moment to moment, just looking at the thought that comes in, saying, is this what I want? Is this how I want to feel? Is this what I want to think? And, you know, like Ken says, if you're on a desert island, well, I'm paraphrasing again, you know, I could only remember two workbook lessons is, I'm never upset for the reason I think, and I could choose peace I could see peace instead of this. You know, that really is at the crux of the choices in the mind that really is very simple, ultimately, that we have the opportunity to look at. I happen to think of a fun pun when you're talking about the Matrix movies. I was thinking, well, in a sense, we're all battling here in a Matrix dream-like movie, if you will. And, you know, mixing movie metaphors and dream metaphors, which I think actually, because it's quick aside, prior to the era of movies and television, the idea of dreams certainly would have been a good metaphor because everybody's had dreams from seemingly time immemorial as we think of it. But anyway, it occurred to me that we're all battling imaginary enemies, so we're all in a neophyte mode, if you will. So, what's that?
Yes, that's very true.
we're all beginners, and we're all trying to fight imaginary enemies. You know,
exactly.
And that's, but we can dodge those bullets, you know, because they're not real. But metaphorically, you know, obviously on the level of form, they sure seem real. But again, it's practicing the kindness. I kind of somehow that reminded me of Don Juan the Carlos Castaneda books. And I remember reading something about when Carlos was asking Don Juan about, you know, what would you do if somebody came out after you with a high-powered rifle? And then his response was, I think it was his one of the other sorcerer mystics, whatever you want to call those folks that he was working with, said, "Oh, I just wouldn't be there." And I think, you know, on the level of form, that seems like, well, you know, maybe that's, you know, getting into the realm of magic. But applied to the level of the mind, that, again, if we can remember to apply anything that comes across as a symbolic classroom opportunity, just this one quote that comes to mind is, well, okay, if I can not be there, that means I can choose to not be there in ego's thought system. If I find myself in what seems to be a dangerous situation, whether it's, you know, your neighbors or having to turn your wheel quickly on the freeway, as I did a couple of years ago when somebody's, you know, tire blew out and they spun around 360 going up I-25 toward Denver. and amazingly, nobody was hurt as this van, you know, crossed about three lines of traffic and everybody managed to get the heck out of the way and give this guy enough room to get off the road. But, you know, those kind of things, when those things come up, when you recognize that there appears to be danger, do what is appropriate. But at the same time, if we can remember, it's like, oh, this is part of a projection of my mind of a fearful dream.
Right.
And in truth, there's nothing more or less fearful in one part than any other part, is there? I mean, it's all based on the idea that we fragmented perfect oneness, we threw God under the bus, whatever metaphor works for you. But none of that happened. You know, it didn't happen.
Exactly. And
we can
just don't believe it.
Yeah.
You can see it, just don't believe it.
Exactly. So let me finish this second paragraph, which I actually kind of did a rewind.
We're doing good.
I know, there's not that much left to read, but it's always fun to digress and hopefully cover this more thoroughly. Okay, the content alone will provide the meaning for you. So what is not what you do that is important, but the purpose you have given to it. With whom you do it, the ego or Jesus. And again, that's those two thought systems that we always switch between moment to moment. There is no hierarchy of illusions. Some activities are not, quote, good for us, and others, quote, bad. Some are not holy and others unholy. The world is not the problem. Therefore, we need sacrifice nothing. It doesn't mean we don't give up things. It just means that the feeling of sacrifice in our mind doesn't need to be, where we go to. It doesn't. We don't have to feel that we're sacrificing anything. I think that's where, again, those six steps in the development of trust in the Manual for Teachers go over a lot about values, because, you know, we think that we know what's valuable and what's unvaluable, and then we have to recognize that we're clueless about that. If we think there's anything in the world that is more or less valuable than something else, we're, you know, putting the cart before the horse again, instead of putting the heart before the course.
Yes. I like the heart before the course. I like it. But that whole value and valuelessness, the whole idea, that is it does bring up the idea of sacrifice, which is what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. And it brings up the idea of scarcity,
right,
and the fact that we are unequally treated by God. And that, I mean, really seriously, when I look at the things that I'm thinking, if someone, maybe I want to play chess on my computer all day, and I that's the only way I feel at peace. Well, then it would be a sacrifice for me to have to get up and go wash the dishes or go and do other things. So I would feel guilty for doing these, you know, playing chess all day because my house was falling apart. But that guilt is, it just feeds into the same projection of the dream over and over. All we're doing is making it more and more and more real, mm-hmm, by believing that one activity has a value over another, and that one thing is more important than another, and that some things are holy and some things are unholy. We're just giving it a value that is that is not what God would think. That's the way I like to look at it. Would God think this? You know, if he saw me playing chess, of course he would get. He doesn't care what I'm doing. I could be, you know, ISIS chopping people's head off. Do you think God cares about that? That's pretty radical. But God does not care because he doesn't see his son as being a weak little being with a head that needs to be on in order to be able to operate. He sees his son as being whole and the body as being nothing. I mean, he doesn't even recognize the body or any activity of the body. So these judgments of, you know, this is good and this is bad, really do put us in a place where you cannot be at peace ever, because you're always going to believe that you're lacking something, you didn't get something, that someone else got something you didn't get, or that you have to sacrifice what you do have in order to be whole. And all of those are misconceptions.
Exactly. And ironically, when we let go of our need to fix the dream that we call the world, that's when we actually are liberated to a much greater extent to do things that reflect a decision for kindness. And then our behavior oftentimes then demonstrates a greater generosity of spirit and kindness and caring. Not because it's something we need to fix in the dream, it's because that's just a natural extension of what we are, because we recognize that our peace and everyone else's peace are the same. And we wouldn't even think of wanting to have harm come to anyone or anything. Not because the form is important, but because we honor and cherish the eternal spirit that is behind all the form. So.
Exactly. And that you know, you said generosity. Isn't that one of the characteristics of a teacher of God? You know, the teachers of God, what we assume to be and we believe we are, you know, all of these things that I'm looking at, the characteristics, trust, honesty, tolerance, gentleness, joy, defenselessness, generosity, patience, faithfulness, open-mindedness. These are all the things that come to you when you stop judging behavior.
Right.
And stop believing in the things of the world. If the development of trust, the first big piece here where he talks about how we actually come to be trusting, once we have developed trust, all the others come to us without any effort, because there's nothing to be afraid of. Once you develop trust, you recognize that there's no difference between anything that seems to be happening here. And, you know, the idea that there is a difference is what keeps the dynamic tension of the world moving.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, yep. All right, did you finish that paragraph?
I don't think I did, actually. Okay, I'll just let me back up just a little less this time. The world is not the problem, therefore we need sacrifice nothing. If we truly want the peace of God, then we will look at how we are using things in the world to interfere with that peace, and then ask for help to use them to undo the interference. And we use things to, you know, make the dream real. We use our issues and our grievances and our upsets and our you know, holy crusades or unholy ones or whatever, you know, that we feel it, like we, the rights we must wrong and the wrongs we must right and you know, or whatever, you know, all that craziness. And I was thinking as you're reading the characteristics that are listed in the manual for teachers of, that all of those are infinitely possible and natural and automatic even from the thought system of the Holy Spirit, which is based on non-duality, because there's no other, just, you know, using generosity as an example, there's no other that is taking away from what we have by our generosity, because we and they are the same. If we equals they, then generosity, talking about the mind, not necessarily form, the generosity in the mind automatically propagates into an awareness that everyone has everything they need and is everything they need. That's from a non-dual standpoint, but from a duality standpoint, we have nothing and we are nothing. And so sacrifice is all there really is, you know, or seems to be in that thought system. And all those characteristics are literally impossible from the perspective of the ego, which is why this is such a challenging curriculum, because we've spent lifetimes, it would seem, identifying with the ego. But we could undo it in an instant if we wanted to. So anyway, I'll finish that last sentence.
Okay.
If we truly want the peace of God, then we will look at how we're using things in the world to interfere with that peace and then ask for help to use them to undo the interference. And I think that's asking for help to undo the interference is really looking at our resistance, our interference, and all the crazy stuff that we put in the way in our minds to the peace. And that's where the forgiveness process comes in. So.
Perfect. Absolutely. And what a dynamic work it is.
It is. It really is. Moment to moment, isn't it?
Moment to moment. So let's go on to the next paragraph. This really is the core of what Jesus discusses in the special function, where he tells us that, quote, forgiveness is the only function meaningful in time. And that's from text chapter 25, section 6. That is a matter of choosing against the ego's purpose for our bodies and relationships, which is separation and specialness, and for the Holy Spirit's, which is forgiveness and peace. The Course is constantly training us to look within and focus on the purpose we are always giving to the interactions and activities in our lives. And remember, purpose is meaning. So whatever the purpose is that we're given to, whatever seems to be happening, is what we think it means, how important it is, what the implications of it are, what it's going to do to me if this happens, or we've given everything a purpose. And that meaning is so individual to each, you know, ego who seems to think that, you know, that it has a meaning, that it can't be the real purpose. It's so specific, it can't be the real purpose, because the real purpose is never specific. The real purpose is always general. It's for everyone. To have, give all to all doesn't mean that I give away everything I have. It means that I recognize that the purpose of anything that I have is for everyone. It's for all things. And so if I give it the purpose of healing and awakening, then that is the intent, and that is the meaning, and that is what I'm going to be looking at everything for. All things are lessons God would have me learn. I would just see that in everything, that the real purpose of everything that seems to be happening is my salvation. And so once I recognize that that's really the only thing that is happening here, is this choice between love or fear. You know, I mean, it's so, you know, like my husband says, that book just repeats itself over and over and over.
It does.
And if I knew what it was saying and it was doing what it was saying, I wouldn't have to look at it anymore. I wouldn't have to worry about how I'm doing this. But the Course is constantly training us to look within and focus on the purpose we are always giving to the interactions and activities in our lives. And fortunately, there are only two possible choices, only one of which will undo the separation, bring us peace, and lead us home. And that the choice is forgiveness, the only function that's meaningful in time. It is so clear. What Jesus is teaching us in this course, and yet how other types of things do we think is going on here? That's all it is. Forgiveness. Mm-hmm. Forgiveness is gold. That's it.
It's very beyond gold.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. It really is. It's our easy ticket out of the nightmare movie, and it's really just a matter of shifting our focus from the dream screen back to the theater of the mind, and realizing, you know. Or certainly our identity, maybe it doesn't mean that we stop paying attention to what's gone on the dream screen. It's just that I think we kind of look beyond it, or look, you know, we transcend the two dimensionality of it. There's a couple of metaphors that I've used recently and for a number of years in different conversations about, you know, the hyper dimensions and all that kind of stuff. If we were to try to understand what a fourth dimensional shape looks like, which there are mathematical shapes called polytopes that are like, imagine a cube, and then there's a thing called a hypercube, probably the most familiar example. If you Google that, you can find all kinds of stuff. And I have a website called geometrycode.com that has all kinds of stuff on the resources page about, you know, multidimensional things, which is kind of fun stuff. Mind play, basically. But there's actually, according to mathematicians, consistent, what they call polyhedra in three dimensions, but they're also polychora and polytopes in higher dimensions. And we can't really imagine those because we see only three spatial dimensions, and that's what this, you know, dream body matrix that we made up is designed to do. And it, you know, it's very intentional, as the Course puts out the idea that it's very intentional. But at the same time, you know, that's just an arbitrary set of dimensions, right? I mean, how do we know that there isn't another hallucinated reality on four or five or more dimensions? But if you can imagine that we can see shadows, if you will, of these four-dimensional shapes, for example, in three dimensions, and that's what you may have seen animations of hypercubes kind of morphing through themselves. Maybe you haven't, but that's okay. But if you think about, you know, the fact that we're seeing a distortion or a limited version of reality when we see a three-dimensional shadow of a four-dimensional object, it's kind of like the Edwin Abbott story called Flatland that was written about a century or so ago, I think, where he imagined, like on a flat piece of paper, a whole world made up of Flatlanders. And so the story I like to tell, it's, you know, kind of leverages off of his little, very short little story about Flatland, is what if the people in Flatland suddenly, if I was, as a three-dimensional person, wanting to have a prank on the people in Flatland, all I'd have to do is poke a pencil through their reality. And as the pencil lead goes through the paper, they, in two dimensions, all they would see is a black circle, right? And then the black circle would get bigger, and then it would be a brown circle when it gets to the wood. And then it would become a yellow hexagon when it goes through the painted part of the pencil. And it would be a yellow hexagon for a long time. And then at which point they'd probably pick up their two-dimensional Flatland version of their phones, calling the two-dimensional version of National Enquirer, saying, hey, I'm having this massive hallucination, you know, get a reporter here right away, kind of thing. And then it would turn into maybe a green circle, slightly larger, with a metal band that holds the eraser. And then it would be slightly smaller pink circle when the eraser is going through, and then poof, it would disappear altogether. And they would think, wow, what a hallucination. Well, it's really no different, I think, than what the illusion that we've made for ourselves in this world, where things seem to appear and disappear, and you know, magic seems to happen, and now we have technology that we can kind of believe it and explain it, but it's still basically a magical kingdom with the tip of the hat to Disney, right?
Yeah. Well, and think about this, that you know, you said there could be other dimension, whatever. If you can think about it, it is. Because this came from the imagination of the Son of God, the mind of the Son of God, which is going to include everything you can imagine. So that doesn't mean that it's real. It just means that it's there. If you look for it, you're going to find it. And that's what we've consistently throughout history. Once we say, oh, there should be another element in this periodic table because, look, there's a gap here. Oh, we'll look for it and we've got to find it. Wow, there it is. There should be another star off over here because we see evidence of it. Let's go look. And sure enough, we find it. Because that's, I mean, if you think about it, oh, you know, someday we'll be able to go to the moon. You know, when I was a kid, I had Books of Knowledge was a encyclopedia that was really kind of big during the day, back in the day. And my parents, we had friends who had a set, and they got a new set of Britannicas or something, and they gave me these Books of Knowledge, which were like really, I mean, I read them cover to cover. They were like probably 20 volumes, and it was just
wow,
the coolest thing of all this knowledge. And it had, I mean, it had everything. And but there was an article in there, and this was in probably 19, it was, this was written, like this was published in the, maybe the 40s or the 30s or something. So it was old news. It wasn't new knowledge.
Right, right.
But it said, man would never be able to go to the moon because the moon is uninhabitable. And there would be no way that we could even actually be able to power a ship to go there. And all these scientific reasons why it couldn't happen.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, I'm reading these books as a little kid. And then, you know, what happens? Oh, we start going in space and we go to the moon eventually. But that wasn't for quite a bit later. But you know.
and now even with our technology, we do, as Alice in Wonderland would say, six impossible things before breakfast, you know, with our laptops and cell phones and TVs and whatnot.
I know it's just going, it's just they're like exploding all this. I mean, it's like almost it's beyond what would be considered normal as far as, you know, what we're learning, growing, knowing. Still, we're really clueless. I mean, it doesn't really matter. But because there's nothing going on.
Exactly.
You know, it may seem like everything is exploding exponentially and we're having, you know, all these great, great breakthroughs and, you know, we're finding these planets and we're finding these things, you know, and things down under the earth and things in the ocean and, you know, things inside our bodies and, you know, we're discovering, and it's all bullshit. Excuse my language, but yet none of it is really anything what we are. It's just a way of keeping our fascination with the dream, keeping our interest in the dream. And there's nothing wrong with that either, because it's entertaining, like I said before.
It's all fertilizer for our forgiveness classroom, right?
Exactly.
Should I read the last paragraph?
You want me to, or are you?
Oh, go for it. Yeah.
Okay. How about I do that? Let's see. It is quite normal to be inconsistent in this process of shifting from outside to within and from the ego's purpose to the Holy Spirit's. We are tremendously fearful of the implications of letting go of our ego. And so we bounce back and forth. But as we experience more and more the peace and calmness of mind that comes when we forgive, we will be motivated to choose it more frequently. And that I'm just going to do an aside here. The experience is an experience of peace. So, you know, the more you get used to it, the more you get used to going into a peaceful place instead of a fearful place. And that's, you know, you just keep wanting to go there. So as we experience more and more the peace and calmness of mind that comes when we forgive, we will be motivated to choose it more frequently. Then the discomfort of being in our wrong minds will become more noticeable and could be experienced as a kind of external pressure to do better. It is just that we are denying less, and the pain that was always there is coming into our awareness. This is a pain, again, it's always there. You're experiencing it right now.
Exactly.
You know, you're experiencing pain and suffering right now because in how many ways you're choosing to see it, to be that way, to be in that situation. You know, right now I'm experiencing, oh, my back hurts. You know, right now I'm experiencing I need to use the restroom. These are all things that I'm experiencing because why? I'm choosing to experience that as a negative thing, as a thing that is not helpful. And, you know, I can choose again every little discomfort, whether it's physical, mental, emotional, whatever, you can always choose again. So even though it could seem like someone else or some other factor is making me do it, really I'm the one who's choosing. And it's just that we are denying less, and the pain that was always there is coming into our awareness. Jesus never exerts pressure or imposes sanctions. That would be the ego's Jesus. Our egos, eager to subvert our work with the Course, will tempt us to distort Jesus' gentle message of forgiveness into a threatening message of judgment. The more we recognize that intrusion, the more we can learn to simply smile at its silliness and allow the non-judgmental, comforting presence of love in our minds to be the source of all we do. And that's it. Just smile at the silliness and be comforted by, you know, the fact that we're here. We're all in heaven. This what appears to be happening is not real. Exactly. And that's a gift.
It is. And when we recognize that whether it's a mini or a mega a dark night of the soul, you know, or maybe as Douglas Adams might say, a dark tea time of the soul. it really is just a revelation that insanity, which is the default of ego's thinking, has been there all along, and we've just, you know, tried to ignore it and try to, you know, sweep that elephant under the rug kind of thing. But eventually we realize, you know, that has been there all along. We just need to see the contrast between how the peace we feel when we let go of it and the agony, really, of trying to reconcile what's irreconcilable in a thought system of duality, that a thought system that suggests that our interests are separate from anyone else's or that we're different from anyone else, again, on the level of mind, which is where this entire curriculum is pitched at. So. Anyway, thank you so much, Lynn, as always, for sharing this hour and a half with me and for everyone who's listening. And I'm always reachable at acimblog.com and on Facebook and places like that. So anyway, have a great week, everyone, and we'll catch you next time. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much, Bruce Rawls. And join us again next week at the House of the Risen Sun. Let me find my mouse here. Stop this recording.